So, I'm an X-ray astronomer, and I shouldn't be here, because X-rays should have nothing to do with young stars and young planets, because everything is too cold to make 10 to the 7 or 10 to the 8 degree plasmas. And yet, I am here, because there are hot plasmas. And the real question is, what can we learn about it, aside from learning that there are X-rays? So this is the first time that I've ever given this talk. It's the first time I think this talk has ever been given in the world, in history. And it's maybe disorganized, but at the same time, it's provocative. Okay, you can believe what I say, but it's not as though I'm talking about finished work. I'm talking about the beginning of a whole enterprise. And the question is, what part of this enterprise is worth climbing and we're working on, and what part is sort of trashy and boring? And I don't know the answer to that. Okay. So this is very much of a nascent business. We have a lot of observers. We don't have any in-house theorists. We really need theorists. You cannot believe how good it is for me to be here this week, this month. This is the right time for me to talk to theorists. So, I'll give you some brief motivation, partly your own motivations. I'm going to talk about, give you three examples just empirical examples of what we do, and then I'm going to get into three themes: IMS, cluster structure, and triggering around H2 regions. And you're going to see that I'm sort of going to intersperse about six different observations during this talk, and each of these are papers that are either published in the last few months, or in press, or coming up in the next few months. So they're all very new, and you probably don't know any of this. And then I'll end with one remarkable case that I think is quite interesting. So I'd like to start with your questions. So I went to the web, and I read your big questions, and I chose a few of them. Your big question number 4 is, what determines the IMF, and does it vary? Your number 5 was, how do massive stars, OB stars, form, and might they form in isolation or not? And number 6 is, how do clusters form? And we're going to talk about clusters and what's the cluster IMF again, and also mass segregation and related issues. You had individual talks, a talk on competitive accretion by Ian Bunnell. You had a talk on H2 region triggering of star formation by Inutsuka. Mark, who's in the room, spoke about high-mass star formation in the core, and Jonathan Tan talked also about sort of a smooth cluster. And in one of your discussions, Rolf sort of laid a theme he didn't answer the question, do we see a concordance model of star formation emerging, but it has to agree with the properties of clusters, the masses, the binarity, the kinematics, and the spatial distributions. And that's that. So the question is, will I be addressing these big questions? And the answer is, I don't know, somewhat. But it's all new and provocative in that sense. Now, before I actually talk, I want to tell you what I'm not going to talk about. This is sort of an advertisement for the rest of the week. I'm here all week. And say that if any of these interest you, I have a whole nother talk or other papers or just conversations about these things. So for instance, by taking a census of the weakly anti-Tauri stars that we're very good at, we can in principle catalog star formation efficiencies and histories better than anyone else. X-rays may ionize clouds and may impede antipolar diffusion, and so X-rays might affect clouds. When I say magnetic fields here, I'm not talking about cloud magnetic fields. It's stellar magnetic fields. Where did they come from, and what are the nature of dynamos and fully convective stars? What's the physics of magnetic reconnection, are some X-ray flares from star disk magnetic fields? The answer is, we don't know, and perhaps, okay, it's not so clear. I'm going to, on Wednesday, down to UCLA, I'm giving a talk on this topic, which is the effects of the X-rays on protoplanetary disks. First, we actually get wonderful samples of disk-free stars, and that helps with disk evolution studies. The disks and the X-rays can heat and ionize and create MRIs and dead zones and do all sorts of wonderful things for planet formation. And the flares might actually affect your solids, both annealed silicates and chondrules and things like this. There's a whole little tempest in a teapot about the nature of OB winds. I'm not going to go into it at all here. But there's probably magnetic fields in O stars and multiplicity. Maybe I do have one slide on this. And then,
before you go on, so what do you mean by ultra-hard O-wind spectrum?
I'll show you one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. they're popping up. we just take a telescope and we see these things that shouldn't be there, and then sort of bizarre. The physics of H2 regions was thought to have been resolved by Donald Menzel and Donald Osterbrock about 80 years ago, and they ended up, I think, they're totally wrong. There is no Stromgren sphere. It's a Stromgren shell at most. And I think we see diffuse X-rays filling the H2 regions. This is going to influence supernova remnant astrophysics, I think, because supernovas don't go into cold media, they go into our medium that we see. This is the work of Lisa Townsley, is the specialist on this, and I'm interested in this, and I don't know, we all work on all these things. There's a review in PP5 that covers some of this, and in this talk itself is something of a review.
Can I ask about line 2? Isn't that going to be important when you discuss?
No, I'm not going to talk about it.
No, I know you're not going to talk about it, but isn't it important?
I have no idea. Why don't we talk about it offline? Okay. It certainly doesn't show up. No, it doesn't. I do have things to say, but not today. Not here. Okay, this is just, I'm an observer. I have a telescope. And if you know observers in your field, you probably know about Spitzer and Herschel, or maybe about JCMT and ALMA. And the question is, well, what do you know about Chandra? Well, why should you know anything? It's made from black holes. Well, it's the third great observatory, which means it cost $4 billion. That's what great observatory means. Great and expensive. These are the best mirrors ever produced by humankind. Okay? It's like a huge surface polished to like, a tenth of a nanometer precision. It has to be polished to a nearly atomic accuracy to reflect X-rays efficiently. And we get very, very fine resolution and brilliant astrometry. This really helps us as astronomers to just, we can tell you what star it is without any ambiguity, at least very, very well. The lead detector is here. Every picture I'm going to show you were these four CCDs. And the PI of this was Professor Gordon Garmeyer, Penn State, the man who hired me 25 years ago. and it's a brilliant detector. It's nearly noiseless, high quantum efficiency, and moderate spectral resolution. And you'll be seeing data from these four CCDs over and over again. It may not highly processed data, but that's what you're seeing. And this is now not a trivial slide, okay? I put this together last week. I said, what were all the fields that Chandra has looked at as of today and actually as of up to next year? Within 500 parsecs, we looked at, actually, this is mainly an XMM project, but Taurus, Ophiuchus, Chameleon, blah, 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 or Orion, or the Orion complex. We haven't done completely, but we've done a lot of it. You'll hear about this project in just a minute. We're doing a lot at Penn State in particular. The red is Penn State. At intermediate distances, around 2 kiloparsecs, you'll be seeing W3, M17, Rosette, IC1396, RCW36, I'll show you, and CPHOBE3. I'll show you mostly from this packet here. Lisa just got a very large project for Carina. Lisa earned a large project for W3 and W6, 17. I mean, we have millions of seconds of data. It's just unbelievable what's coming out of Chandra. It's very hard to publish it, but we're finally getting through the logjam. So I want to show you one of these. This is the one that I directed, so I sort of get to talk about it. We published a book on it, and in 2005 I've got it, and a bunch of other papers. There's another book, thick special issue of ANA on Taurus that just came out a few weeks ago. So here it is. Here's the four CCDs. They're 17 arc minutes subtended. And you can see now that we not only get the positions and the brightness, but we get colors. Now, of course, these are fake colors. It's X-ray colors. Blue means it's absorbed, and red means it's foreground. Okay, you know, it's not lightly absorbed. But we also get a fourth dimension. So RA, DEC, energy, three dimensions. Fourth dimension is time, and that's coming up in the movie in a second. In this field, we see almost every single known star, and we even discovered some that weren't previously known. And this is the best characterized star-forming cluster in the sky. We have almost no contamination. In fact, when we have AGN, these are quasars shining through the molecular clouds. We easily can throw them away. We have 1% of our sample. We're not sure what it is. And so this is very advantageous. I'll show you this again with respect to infrared astronomy, where they have lots and lots of sensitivity, but they're very confused by other stars, and they just have a contamination problem. So let's see if I can get the movie going. So now I'm going to show you Coop the movie. This is the best movie ever made in X-ray astronomy, okay? Meaning it has more than about 10 frames. It took 2 weeks of data, continuous observation. And here we go. We're going to zoom in on one sort of corner, and we're going to have 13 days. I'll count the days. Ready? 1, 2, 3, flare, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. Okay, that's it. Okay, let's do it again. I will count them this time. Okay, all the other regions are the same. All stars are flaring all the time. These flares are the most powerful magnetic reconnection flares ever seen in any star. They're equal to the most violent flare seen in other magnetically active stars. In fact, they look just like solar flares. They have feathers like solar flares, they quack like solar flares, and they're ducks, okay? They have the same sharp rise and decay, the plasma heats up and then it cools. We have fit the flares very, very nicely in most cases with solar-like flare models. And there's really no doubt that these are magnetic reconnection flares from magnetic fields, probably most of them attached to the star, just like on the sun. They crackle and reconnect and heat plasma explosively, giving rise to X-rays.
But the amplitudes?
The amplitudes are equivalent to those of something called RACVN binaries, okay?
Relative to a solar flare?
1,000 times stronger,
yes. Right.
Yes. Right. We have an entire spectrum of them. Well, there's no indication of anything that isn't a flare. There's no quiescent corona or anything like that that we see, and there's no accretion. Oh, yes, some of them not in Orion, but some others that are very close and unobscured, there's a very soft component that doesn't flare. And that's probably an accretion column only on accreting stars. It's a very small fraction of the total, but it's very hot for some people. I mean, some people write a lot of papers about it, but it's still a minority of the X-rays. Most of it's flares. Particularly when we look further out, we just can't see any quiescent component at all. Okay, now I want to tell you M17 is, I don't know if you know, but after Orion, M17 is the second brightest H2 region in the sky. It was found by John Herschel in the 1700s, I guess early 1800s. And here it is in JHK. It's sort of, there's a molecular cloud over here. It goes on for miles. And there's a cluster of stars, a rich cluster of OB stars in here. And then this is the H2 region that was thought to be a stronger in sphere. This is now probably bracket gamma, not H alpha. Here it is in H alpha and other optical lines. It's a big mess. You can't really understand it. In fact, very little science comes out of Hubble that's related to our work. But here it is in Spitzer.
What do you see?
Very, oh, Colin, I would have been much more coy had I remembered you were in the room. But
I can't believe you said that.
I'm sorry to say that you have more press releases. A lot of press releases, but very few papers with source lists. Very few. Sorry, but true. Okay, anyways, this is rotated. But this is Spitzer, and Spitzer sees the PEH emission, the illuminated dust here, and now you're going to see this blue is the Chandra emission, that's the diffuse emission that LISA found a few years ago. Now, what I want to talk about are the point sources here. This is our short exposure. Our long one is going to have three times as many sources as this, and we haven't analyzed it yet. That's coming up next year. Excuse me one second. And so we have 900 sources in this field, and we basically see the whole cluster. And then here are the bright H2 regions, those called the bars. And we don't care. We don't see the bars. They don't obscure us. They don't hurt us. This, and then here's deep inside the clouds. And we see we're affected by the obscuration, but not that much. So this sort of summarizes what was known before. There was a rich cluster, ultra-compact H2 regions, two of them here, a little group of protostars up there, and then everything else that was thought was just a stream of stars, but they didn't know which ones were the members. Now, one of the critical things that I'm going to use over and over again is this relationship that's empirical. Here's LX over four orders of magnitude, and here's the mass of the star. We can only do this when we know independently the mass, and this is Taurus, where every star has its own name and has been studied since George Herbig was a young man. And so they all have masses, a tenth of a solar mass, one solar mass, and there's a remarkable nonlinear correlation here. That means that we can empirically, by finding out how bright that is, we can just read off its mass to within some sort of rough precision.
Eric, I thought you said that their x-rays are always blurring.
Yes, actually, it doesn't seem to matter. You can do the quiescent, and it looks the same. And this is time averaged, and it looks more or less the same. In fact, a lot of the scatter is probably due to the flares. So this is a little wordy, but this is my, it's not an argument against infrared astronomy, but it's the argument as to why we are so powerfully complementary to infrared astronomy. For the purpose of finding memberships, and therefore things like structures and IMFs, of young stellar clusters. X-ray selection, it depends on how sensitive we are, but roughly for the ones I'm going to show you, we're sensitive between roughly a half a solar mass. The more sensitive ones, down to 0.2, sometimes 1. For the Orion observation, we went down to the brown dwarfs. It was the only one we're totally sensitive. We see the whole population just about. Above 3 solar masses, for reasons that are too complicated for me to explain here, these are the B stars. We see some of them, but not all of them. We actually don't see the B stars. We see the companions to some of the B stars. But once you get to the early stars, the B zeros, and all the O stars, we see them again. They become very bright. Now, this is critical. Our selection is based on flaring is nearly insensitive to disks, the presence or absence of disks, or the presence or absence of accretion. Therefore, we see class 1, class 2s, and above all, class 3s, to use the jargon of infrared astronomers. Notice we don't see class 0s. They're either too embedded or not emitting. My guess is too embedded. It's consistent with that.
Are you less sensitive to class 1s than class 2s?
Yes, somewhat, because there is some obscuration. We lose factors of 2 or 3, typically. But remember, the X-ray luminosity function is 10 to the 4 wide. So you lose half a magnitude, half an order of magnitude. It's not so bad. It's not so serious.
But the class 0 is really compton thick.
Not compton thick. They just we get absorbed. X-ray absorption is mainly second row of the periodic table K shells. So
No. I mean, you've got 2 bands, right? You've got a hardness ratio.
Oh, yes, spectroscopy. Yes.
Right, and so. Issue is, what would you not see?
I mean, well, class zeros are typically 1,000 visual magnitudes extincted. They're not even seen at 2 microns and often not at 10 microns. They show up in the submillimeter.
But 1,000 is only
our penetrability is very similar to about 10 micron penetrability. For instance, we can
X-ray astronomer. I mean, I just want the column density.
Okay.
So we 2 10 to 24.
Yeah.
So that's
our record is 23 and a half.
Right. I don't see why you can't see them.
They're just too faint. We're down to a few photons at this point. We have 2 which have class 0/1 classification by the infrared astronomer. One of them had 8 photons above 6 keV, and our mirror stops at 8 keV. So we're the wrong instrument.
No, but as you go down in class, does the spectrum get harder?
No. Don't worry about it.
No, I'm worried about it, because you've made a statement that it's not there. I'm not sure.
No. There's none seen. I was very careful.
Right,
none
sure
detected. Well, XMM has tried very, very hard to detect the nearest class zeros with very long exposures, and it failed. Its failure is uninteresting, because it's still consistent with emitting exactly the same as the 1, 2, and 3s, and just being absorbed. So it's not even interesting.
You must see the spectrum get harder.
That's what I'm saying.
Oh, sure.
Do you?
Oh, sure. Of course. Of course we get. I'm sorry.
Wait.
The intrinsic spectrum is not harder. The observed spectrum is, of course.
Well, you said no to that when I.
I'm sorry. I was thinking intrinsic and you were talking observed.
Okay. So as you see obscure, we know all this from quasars.
Yes, of course.
Spectrum. Has to get harder. So
yes.
With that?
Oh, yes, of course.
As you go to the
yes. In fact, we have a very nice correlation between NH and X-rays and AB and optical.
Right.
Sure. Perfect optical.
I misunderstood you.
I'm sorry, Paul. Now, the infrared catalogs are actually much more sensitive than we do. They should typically go down to the brown dwarf regime. If you use the, you know, an 8-meter telescope in K-band, you see everything. But when you look at the more distant regions, you're overwhelmed by field stars. And therefore, they can't do the science of the rich stellar clusters in terms of membership. And therefore, they typically restrict themselves to infrared excess systems, which is 0, 1s, and 2s. But we're finding that 90% of the systems are class 3s. So they often miss a very large fraction of the total sample. They're restricted to the younger ones. And here's an example, Westerlund 2, that ionizes this something called RCW49. In this field, there's 10,000 JHK stars. We only see 500 X-ray sources. But all of our X-ray sources are members, and most of those are not. And very few are both X-ray and infrared X's. Okay, that was my introduction. Now I'm going to go to my first topic. My first topic is IMFs. And now, remember, this is all 2007 studies. We've never done these before. We're treading on grounds that have never been trod. I'm not sure how important it is, okay? So here's an example. This is the Rosette Nebula. Around here is the red light is H-alpha, and in the middle of it is an annular H2 region, and in the middle is a cluster whose name is that, NGC-2244. Discovered in the 1800s or something. It's 1.5 kiloparsecs away, and we have five fields with Chandra, and this is the thesis, centerpiece of the thesis of Junfeng Wang, who's graduating now and is going to be on the job market. He's very good, by the way. So you'll see a lot of Wang et al. 2007s. This is our thesis from Junfeng. So what we've done here, and what you should sort of begin to think about is I don't know if you've heard Charlie Lotta talk over 20 years about KLFs, K-band luminosity functions, in order to find populations of young solar clusters. We're going to talk about XLFs, X-ray luminosity functions. So for the very deep movie I showed you, that's the most deep observation ever. Went down to 10 to 27 on this unit, so it's almost six orders of magnitude depth from the top. That's the dashed line here. So we get a sort of a power law increase until you get to around this number, 10 to the 30 Hertz per second, and then it flattens off as you go to lower and lower luminosities. And since these are all statistically related to masses by that empirical relationship, the XLF is essentially an IMF. This is the one for the Rosette cluster. This dashed line shows our completeness limit for this observation. So below here, we're missing a lot of those M stars and brown dwarfs. And we can plot it here. This is now an IMF, a log mass. I guess some people plot it the other way. That's sort of interesting. So high is over on this side. So this is 20 solar masses, 10 solar masses, 2 solar masses, 1 solar mass, a half, and down to a tenth. And we this particular observation stops being complete around a half a solar mass. So it ends up that our power law slope here, which we also verify using the standard old-fashioned KLF method of Charlie Lotta and many others, is exactly the same slope, as far as we can see, with COOP, Orion Nebula Cluster as well. It extends to higher mass because there are more O stars in Rosette than there are in Orion.
But why, it looks like the most massive ONC star up there you have is less than 10 solar masses.
There are details in this particular plot. We actually took off the O stars from some of these plots on purpose to try to get away from flopping the top end of the XLF to be dependent on different astrophysics, because the wind astrophysics for most stars is different from the flare astrophysics of lower mass stars.
We've taken out
theta 1c. You got to read the captions in a little more detailed. Each plot has slightly different samples. It's sort of subsamples, but they're matched to be coherent. So here's another one. You've all heard of Rosette because, I don't know, maybe you have a telescope, you can see Rosette with binoculars. Here's one you've never heard of. It has almost no papers on it. It's in the southern hemisphere. And here it is in two mass, and you can see a sort of a mass. You can't really say what's there except for some O stars. In fact, it has five of the galaxy's 15 known O3 stars, which are 100 solar mass stars. So we suspected it's a very rich cluster, but no one knew in infrared or optical, and so we thought we'd take a Chandra picture, and there we can see the Chandra picture here superposed in this case on an infrared picture of PAHs. And you can see, here's our 17 arc minute field. We see several hundred, 800 members of the cluster, and that's really nice. In fact, we even doubled the YOBI population that was known. So I thought I'd show you the XLF of this one. So this dashed one here is the COOP, and now the XLF is actually higher than Orion by about a factor of 5 to 10. So we decide that the XLF population is 5 times Orion. So in other words, a single X-ray picture can, by normalizing this high luminosity tail, can basically tell you the total population, sort of in a snapshot. And it's just a fact It may seem uninteresting, it might even be uninteresting, but no one had these facts before. The infrared and optical astronomers can't normalize the populations because they're stuck with disky stars. Now we did this again, here's another one. This is actually part of the Cepheus OB3, which is like 2 degrees big, and here's a molecular cloud here that's being photoionized, and this is a sharp OSH2 region, and there's been known to be some protostars deep inside here. And we decided to take a picture that it was both unobscured and H2 region and triggered star formation inside. And here's an example of our results. We have 400 stars approximately. The colors out here mean unobscured. The dark blue colors means obscured. And whereas they had known of a few protostars, we find a whole population of several dozen of them, most of them again without heavy disks. And for the unobscured ones, we can do the same XLF here. Here's the coupe again. Now the coupe is in red, and now the new one's in green. And this one actually was anomalous. This one did not flatten off at 10 to the 30 like it's supposed to. It went off to 10 to the 29 and 9.6, and then it flattened, or we don't even know, at Compton's limit. And we actually have an unexpected excess of about 30 stars. And if you convert it to mass, we have an anomalous IMF by too many half solar mass stars. Is this true, ladies and gentlemen, those of you who care about IMFs? I don't know.
But you say it's happening, I mean, it looks like it's continuing, so it's...
Yes, it's sort of odd. This one's different.
Right. I know, but I mean, it's not just that there's a delta function of half solar mass stars sticking up there.
Well, actually, it was the same slope here, pretty much. Mm-hmm. So that's the easy... We don't know why, okay? And that question mark is really a question mark. I'm not promoting it. So Junfeng put together, as of about this summer, what did we know about all of them? This is the integral X-ray luminosity function. And the long one here is, again, coupe. That's Chandra, the Orion Nebula cluster. And the point is that most of them are pretty similar. We had hoped that there would be a universal IMF. But there seems to be some differences in slope and some differences a little bit, wiggles, a little bit.
Does the cluster age move through around this?
We don't think so. We have a cluster age, a cluster versus age, individual stars that have been individually personally aged in both Taurus and Orion, and for those we do X-rays. And when we stratify for mass, okay, then we find almost no age effect on the pre-main sequence. They start decaying on the main sequence, Pleiades, Hyades, and field stars. It goes down steeply. That's what gives us the advantage in no contamination. There's no field star contamination. They're down a factor of 1,000. But there seems to be very little age effect, but it may still be there. So I want to say that within 5 years, we're going to have 20 or 30 of these curves here, and we're going to do big IMF studies and X-rays, or we'll call it XLF IMF studies. And are we going to learn anything? I don't know. At the moment, things look pretty normal in the sense of universal IMF. So I think I would probably personally say that it looks more like it's universal than not. We could have found. No one had been able to do an IMF around one solar mass before. You know, 0.5 to 5 solar masses, where we're very good. And the fact we found that they were more or less the same is good news for the universality of the IMF. Okay, my second topic, ladies and gentlemen, is the physical structure of clusters. In other words, where are the stars? And I'm going to show you these color smooth graphs that Junfeng invented, which don't show X-ray luminosity. They just simply take where the stars are and smooth them out in the sky. So you don't have to look at dots. You can look just sort of smooth. So here we are. Surface density is now 3 orders of magnitude of stellar surface density, stars per square arc minute. And sometimes we can do stars per square parsec. And this one happens to be NGC 6357. This was the one, I don't know if you remember, but there's a sort of cavity in the pH and the infrared. This was off center. It didn't look like this cluster had blown that bubble because it was off center. So we found a little tiny group of 30 extra stars that was in the middle. Is this the remnant of the original cluster? I don't know. No optical astronomer's taken a spectrum of them yet. We're trying to commission that southern hemisphere VLT or something. So maybe we'll know in a year or so what those stars are to see if...
The cavity, Eric?
A few parsecs across.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of the half a degree. Effect, though, I mean, to get to a few parsecs doesn't take that long.
It just, it seems odd that this one was off-center. That oddity had been noted before. The H2 region was not centered on the cavity.
Cooling time of those
X-rays? There's no diffuse X-rays in this particular picture. These are individual stars, about 500 individual stars smoothed together. So it's important to realize that this is not diffuse, this particular picture. There's another talk, which I have here, by Lisa Townsley, on the diffuse emission, which is about two orders of magnitude fainter than this, very faint. We have to take out all these stars and look for something left, and very faint, we can see it in several cases.
Where is that center?
That's centered on the cavity. Thank you very much. Good question. Thank you. This is a good question, a good conversation. That's centered on the cavity and actually shows the lobate structure of the cavity. We fill the cavity very nicely. But more or less, this is a spherical cluster. So we're learning something about cluster morphology simply by looking at this round thing. But I'd like to point something out. This thing's 2.5 kiloparsecs away, and I forgot, this is 10 arc minutes or something, when you convert it to surface stellar density number per square parsec, and plot this not in arc minutes, but in parsecs, 2, 4, 6, 8 parsecs. This picture goes out in radius to 8 parsecs and 4 orders of magnitude down. Amazingly, the Orion Nebula cluster is not even 2 parsecs big. It's huge. It's monstrously bigger. This is something that no optical or infrared astronomer ever told you because they can't do it due to their contamination. But there's a wide range in sizes. And this, if you convert to stars per cubic parsec, it's actually a little lower in central density, probably not dramatic, maybe 1 order of magnitude lower, but mean 3 orders of magnitude, 2 orders of magnitude bigger in volume. It's a big, lower density monster, but it has O3 stars. So I think that this is another thing that you people should think about. Can you use these kinds of plots, maybe even stars per cubic parsec, usefully in your research when you...
Where are the O3 stars in?
I'm sorry? They're in the middle.
Okay.
Yeah. In this case, you'll see a case where... is it the next slide? No, a couple slides, you'll see a case where it's not. Okay, let's look at the morphology of M17. So I already showed it to you to just introduce you to X-ray pictures. Now we'll get into some details. So here it is in infrared again. This happens to have the contours from carbon monoxide to show this molecular cloud that's confining it. And here's the diagram I think I showed you before that shows our stars. But let's now smooth the diagram. And we took out the quasars. And we can see that for the lightly obscured stars, every star we know its absorption, so we just divide them in half. We just, I think, 5 visual magnitudes. We just chose a number. And so these are the relatively lightly obscured stars. And you can see it looks spherical. Not quite spherical, but at least it has a single peak and it goes off radially in all directions, a little asymmetrically perhaps. But when we ask for what are the embedded or at least heavily obscured stars, where are they in the picture, in the sky? It's no longer so simple. First, we do see the cluster, that's the same position as this. But we see something new up there that's never been reported by anyone. So we're calling it M17-X for X-ray, or maybe we discovered a cluster, okay? We rediscovered the M17 North group of protostars. There we go. We found many more members to it than they knew about. And what really is remarkable is this. This is a elongated, like 2 parsecs long and 0.5 parsec wide. It's like a trough of extra stars that doesn't have any concentrations. It's not like a cluster. It's a stripe of young stars. It's elongated along and behind the PDR, the very famous shocked photo dissociation region called M17 Southwest Bar. And there is one ultra-compact H2 region in there that's well known called UC1, but most of these were unknown except for a very obscure paper by Zhang, a Chinese using a Japanese telescope called Sirius. Nobody recognized that paper. It's really interesting. They actually discovered this in K-band excess sources before us, but we confirmed it very clearly. I want you to know I actually think this is one of the best and most interesting examples of triggered star formation that we have. Because we know their members. It's not a round cluster. It's not an isolated thing. What is it? It's a triggered front of star formation. Hundreds and hundreds of stars there. because we don't actually see them all. We maybe see dozens and dozens. They represent hundreds because we know the XLF is incomplete. So this is actually quite an interesting point, both in morphology and therefore in triggering.
So the M17X, is that similar to the BNKL cluster?
It looks bigger and more diffuse, but we decided not to talk much about it because we're getting 6 times more data. And so we quickly wrote our paper on the old data, and now we're going to do it much better next time. Next time will be next year when we get over our other observations. It's part of our, 20 papers we have to write in the next couple of years. Okay.
What about the IMF in that bar?
We don't know. Thank you. It's the next paper. Yes, we will be able to do that. We will do all the IMF studies, all the studies for the bar in the hard band only, and that requires a certain refinement, but it's not very hard for us. Okay, we're doing morphology still. This is my last example of morphology. The rosette. Now, this is the central field of rosette. There's actually several more fields go into the cloud. I'm not going to show those because I'm just not going to run out of time. But we have a triggered cluster over here called NGC 2237. So Zhenfeng Wang's thesis is full of interesting morphologies. I'm just going to show you one. It's the central cluster because it's most similar to the Orion and M17 and rosette. And this is not rosette. Here we have all just a symbol for all the stars, and the big symbols here are the famous O stars that have been known for many, many decades. This one is a 100-mass star, and this one is an 80-solar-mass star. These are the two biggies. This one has no companions in X-rays. It's isolated. This one has 50 companions, and here's the inner 20 of them. These were totally unknown. Because if you go to an optical picture, they're all sitting there inside the blur of the optical image. Now, obviously, one could do AO, but this is 2-mass. The point is that Chandra is higher resolution than most available telescopes. And we're going to promote, I hope, people start doing AO and find these stars and characterize them. But we basically find that there is an amazing subcluster of about 50 stars around this O star, but not the other O star. So this leads to a speculative graph that sort of is meant for the theorists, not for the observer. RA and DEC is observer space. And stars per parse something parsec, and sparsecs, that's theory space. I mean, that's actual physics, physical space. So now we've taken the same sort of radial profiles for 3 of our different clusters here, and we've plotted them. So here it is, for instance, for rosette, and it looks like an isothermal sphere, except for if you take the 50 around the central star, it's slightly off-center, but if you center your graph around that star, it looks like a power law cusp within one parsec. There's 50 stars here. Those of us who are old enough, Colin, remember the power law cusp around black of stars around black holes?
No, because you're much older.
Yeah. Anyways, they used to talk about this, the slope of this for stars around black holes in equilibrium. But there's no black hole here, ladies and gentlemen. This is star formation. So those of you who like to make O stars, sometimes please create a power law cusp of lower mass stars that's about half or one parsec in size. Sometimes please do it, but not all the time, because the other star didn't show it.
Are they all binaries?
No.
In the power law cusp?
No. Oh, I have no idea. That's a good question. I have no idea.
Do you know if that
O-star is binary? Okay, well, Colin, finish.
They might segregate in if they have binaries.
They could be slightly more massive and have segregated in, or they. I personally think they were born there, but I really don't know.
Yeah,
Mark.
For the isolated O-star, do you have any information on the spatial velocity?
No. We have obviously looked at all available information, but the quality of proper motion information for 2 kiloparsecs is pathetically poor. And so we actually do not have adequate information about it. Well, there's a little bit of information. It suggests it's not a runaway, but I don't not necessarily believe it. There's other cases where it's wrong. proper motions when there's lots of diffuse structures around us is a dubious effort.
I was wondering at radial velocity.
No, well, we'd love to do it. It could be done in 5 minutes. Anyone have Southern telescopes? I mean, this is not hard. Okay, we really need colleagues at different wavelengths.
Just go back a little bit more sensibly. I mean, yep. What are the dotted lines?
Okay, this one is the cusp that we found around NGC 6357, around those O3 stars. And then one could say that there was an isothermal sphere outside of it, because if you took the parallel and went down, it misses slightly. This one definitely looks like two components. Two-component cluster structure, that's my interpretation. Inner component, outer component. COOP is a little less clear. COOP looks, we completely disagree with the optical astronomer on the size of the isothermal sphere of COOP. So maybe one could say it's debatable, it's debated as to exactly what the isothermal sphere is. But maybe it's not an isothermal sphere, maybe it's a power law. Or maybe that's why we're all debating what the size of the sphere is. Maybe it's not
why
a very.
Why are you different from the optical astronomer?
We don't differ very much. It's more a question of our models differ than our data, because Orion was so well studied that we don't really add much to it. And the other clusters, and like I said, a few years from now, we may have 10 or 20 of these graphs. And so this is the beginning of a study, not the end of a study. And I'd very much like to know, are you interested in this graph? And maybe you say, no, Eric, I'm interested in another graph. And can you produce another graph for my theory? And I think we'll try to help you guys.
Is the trapezium taken out of that plot?
No. Oh, yes, that's correct.
Okay, because
the trapezium, there's only five stars in the trapezium.
Okay, yeah, I mean, people normally quote as sort of the peak density. I'm thinking volume density. It's sort of quote volume densities up to 10 to the five stars per cubic parsec in the center of Orion, which I guess is sort of compatible with what you've got.
Can you use your mass estimator and fold that in to turn
that
into
density? I haven't done that. Mass density. Yeah, that's a great idea, Tom.
I wonder whether you get still at the same slope.
I think that's an excellent idea. That could either accentuate the two components or blur them away, them adding masses in. That's not crazy at all. That would be an X-ray luminosity weighted spatial diagram. And I think that's a very good idea. Thank you very much. Okay, now this is in the section called structure, but it's a structure so small that it's almost down. It's really addressing big question number five, what's the origin of massive stars? So are we going to be able to talk about OB star formation and help you guys and, you know, the many interesting ideas you have and models you have for the formation of massive stars? And I think the answer is no, we're not going to do it directly. But can we help you sort of indirectly with little pieces of information? And the answer is, I don't know, maybe. First of all, I just showed you a case where we effectively locate low-mass stars near OB stars. Now, near means within an arc second, so choose your distance. So we're not talking about close binaries here. We're talking about not even what people call multiple systems. We're talking about these cusps, these sort of groupings of stars.
But can you distinguish?
We're pretty good down. In the nearest case, we got down to 500 AU. This was a strange case. I got to tell you about this. We've been staring at, since the very first day Chandra went up, we have Orion pictures, okay? And we have the lousiest astronomy I've ever done as an observer was talking about the Beckley-Neugebauer object in X-rays. Because we couldn't decide if we saw it. We've now decided that we have a source that's 1.1 arc seconds away, that's very bright. And if you deconvolve it, we have a very faint source in the Beckley-Neugebauer object. The Beckley-Neugebauer object is a high radial velocity, a high proper motion velocity B star. It's going through the molecular cloud, the densest part of the molecular cloud. By chance, it's probably ejected from the trapezium. It's not me, other theorists have said this. But what they don't know is that it was ejected with a companion that's booming in X-rays. So those of you who need to eject stars when you have dynamical collapse of dense OB systems, multiple OB systems, please figure out how to eject a 500 mass, 500 AU binary, maybe one solar mass, right along with your early B star. Well, make sure that you can do that.
Yeah, So that sort of size scale, actually, that sort of separation is interesting because the disk fragmentation models for massive star formation predict that companions, you know, one solar mass type companion should form
with separations of, you know, order of 100 AU.
Well, actually, the best work being done in Orion is actually not X-ray work. It's speckle IR work. And there's wonderful new studies on the high multiplicity of the trapezium stars. I recommend you look at it. Both work going back a few years and very new work as well.
So what was the technique you used there to decide there were two X-ray sources?
Image.
It's not obvious to me there's a
No. We maximum likelihood deconvolution of our point spread function and a lot of head scratching. So it's not obvious to us.
And
most
at what significance level?
Oh, it's there, yes.
When
you do maximum likelihood, there's no significances left. You just have to convince yourself. So you can read our paper and see whether you're convinced. Okay? It took us 4 years to convince ourselves that this was the right answer. Other than that, well, we have an astrometric error that's far bigger than the VLA permits in VLBA. In other words, we have astrometry that doesn't match. And I've got telescopes with optics. I can't get one star misplaced. I just can't do it.
Okay, Crystal, try it out. How many counts do you have in those two over there?
840.
40?
Yeah. They're blurred together. We have deconvolution algorithms. I just didn't show you. Please, I got this paper on my desk. Come on over and you can take a look at it.
What did you do for your name? Crystal, give us.
It's a Lucy Richardson deconvolution. It's not very hard, okay?
Okay, it's fancy, but
what do you mean it's fancy? Lucy wrote it down 30 years ago.
It's 40 counts. If you think of how many counts you get from the central object in that annular.
Yes. We did it. We did lots of control sources all around. None of them show. They don't show companions right next to them in exactly that right spot, exactly a coincident with the VLA source. But this one does. Okay, so the companion is right on top of the VLA source. Okay, so it's pretty convincing.
But we have a right to be skeptical.
Oh, yes. In fact, I sweated on this for years, and I finally convinced myself this is right.
But then how do you know it's physically associated?
I could be another companion.
No, but you say a companion, maybe it's just a back. Could it be?
Within a couple tenths of an arc second, it's not going to be a background source, but it could be another companion.
Another star, because it is very hard to eject.
The B star may be a triple, and I'm not joking, because the trapezium stars are quintuplets and they haven't finished yet. They're all highly multiple systems. All O stars. This has nothing to do with me. It has to do with optical AO studies of the trapezium stars. All OB stars are high multiplicity when you have the resolution and dynamic range to study them.
Not runaways.
I'm sorry?
Not runaways.
Nobody knows. Nobody's done the AO studies that I know of. I agree. That's why I'm mentioning this. I think that you guys should know that if the Beckmann-Langebauer is a runaway, then I have convincing evidence it has a companion.
Right.
Okay.
I guess what I'm suggesting is that one way of having a companion would be is if you eject it not as a binary system, if what you eject is a star with a disk.
And how do you keep the disk if you're kicking it out at tens of kilometers?
Well, you'll strip out the outer part of the disk, but then you've got the inner part of the disk, and it'll viscously respread back out to that size scale.
Right, but then will it have enough mass to actually make a epsilon mass star?
Possibly. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of mass in the inner disk, so
that's true.
It may work.
Okay, I think Mark has a good idea.
Okay, I think Mark has a good idea.
I know this is a fancy theoretical idea and very pretty, but I don't believe it's to invoke it, because if you've got 800 counts writing that central logic at pretty poor resolution, then any blob of 30 counts is not significant. And he's talking about a blob of 40 counts. Right? And the only point is that it's on right exactly on his object.
Yeah.
So,
It could be bad luck.
Which has 30 counts in them.
It could be bad luck, but it's very unlikely to be bad luck.
Okay, but before Mark goes off and writes a paper on this,
he should read this paper and see whether he's convinced. And if he's not convinced, he should not do any theory.
Right, but if he is convinced,
then you have to confront it as an observation.
I'm glad he planned my future project.
Right. Okay. Now, I know this sounds like astrophysics of X-ray emission. I promise not to talk about X-ray flares or something, but O stars emit X-rays by shocks inside of their during the radiative accelerative regime of their inner winds. They emit soft X-rays in a quasi-constant way, like psh, like that, soft X-rays. Unfortunately, we're finding that a reasonable fraction, we now have tens and tens of O star spectra. We're not the only ones. There's other scientists with Chandra and XMM doing this. everyone has surprisingly hard components. There's a sort of a 2 keV component that shows up. It's 20 million degrees, too hot for the standard Owaki shocks. And that's thought to be something called magnetically confined wind shocks that Malt, Merlin, Cohen, and others have talked about. But there's actually an ultra-hard component that shows up occasionally up to 10 keV. That means 100 million degree plasma in an O-star wind. It shouldn't happen in the wind. The only way it can happen, and it's thought to occur, known for certain Wolf-Rayet-close binaries, is colliding wind binaries. Two O-stars very close to each other going around each other, and their winds slam together at 3,000 kilometers per second net velocity and emit up to 100 million degree plasmas. And this particular one not only shows that, but also shows change on timescales of hours on 1 year, and in another year was constant. So we're actually very, very puzzled. This is a rather remarkable 100 solar mass system. So we're going to be writing some papers. Actually, Lisa Townsley and Marc Gagné are going to be writing some papers on O-star astronomy, and some of them will be O-star binarity. They think this one might be an eccentric binary, and an eccentric binary was just found in the Orion Nebula Trapezium as well by optical astronomers.
So all the cases you know where you have is, because it's hard to see low mass companions to O-star, but I thought at least the nearby O-stars, if there is a binary O-star, you would know.
Yes, if it's more than an arc second away, then we can resolve it just because we resolve everything in an arc second. And I think I might have even had a picture.
Well, I guess I'd ask, do the optical astronomers know about O-star binaries?
Often they do, and often they don't. And if they do, they know because 30 years ago somebody did radio velocities. They know for very old-fashioned reasons. So, I'm sorry, I'm a little lost on the second. Okay, my last topic, I did IMFs, I did structure, and now I'm doing triggering. And by triggering, it's not star spiral galaxy triggering. I'm talking about triggering inside of an H2 region. Here is a young stellar cluster. There's an O7 star, not very interesting. And the point is this particular one, its name is IC1396. It's very well known. It's very nearby. This picture's about 2 degrees big. It has these blobs where there's known to be triggered protostars in there. In fact, I don't know if you know, but this little shape there, there's a whole Spitzer movie on that one. It's kind of cute. So we took, actually, Costa Getman, my colleague, took a Chandra picture, a very short one, of one of these globules saying, gee, I wonder if there's a couple known protostars inside. And here it is. You can see that little globule there is this little globule here. And the background picture is an optical picture showing H alpha, I guess. It's photo evaporated and photo ionized. A bright-rimmed cloud, or cometary globule. This is the jargon associated with these elongated structures on the surface, on the edges of H2 regions. The O-star is down here. What he was able to do, since he's able to get rid of all the background and foreground stars, is he's able to show that he has some older WTT reline, few million-year-old stars here, a whole bunch of classical T-Tauri stars here, and protostars here in the middle. And this is only the second time. The first time was Uguro and Tsukutani, 2007. So there were two simultaneous reports, one from optical people. They spent 10 years at it. We spent half a day at it and a couple months writing a paper. It's much easier to do this research with Chandra than on the optical. And I want you to see that the young stars are actually in front of where the cloud is today. So the cloud used to be probably bigger. And a few million years ago, it was out here. And then it made some stars in the middle, and they're out here. And then it made stars a million years old there. And today it's making stars in here. And tomorrow it'll make stars over here, and then it'll be gone. And so this is a spatial temporal sequence. It agrees very well with the standard theory for this. It's one of the few cases where there's a clean theory, astrophysical theory, for triggering. It's not hocus pocus. It's called RDI, radiative driven implosion. There have been papers about the physics of it that more or less all agree with each other, and our data agree with those predictions very nicely.
Yeah, but I asked about the age because what mm-hmm. I'm surprised at is that the implied velocity is very small.
Yes, in this case, correct. In the next case, it's not so clear. Thank you very much. It implies very interesting things. They may not be all the same. Okay. Here's another bright rim cloud cometary globule. This one is bizarro. Okay, nobody understands this. Okay, there's a paper back in 1977 that says we don't understand this. The thing's more than a degree long. Okay, Okay, it's about 500 parsecs away. We confirm that distance. It's like 10 parsecs long and one parsec across. It's huge. The problem is, it's 25 degrees above the galactic plane. And not only that, there should be an O star up here irradiating it, and there's no O star. This is the world's most mysterious triggered star formation region, because we don't know what's triggering it. And this mystery has been around for years. Its name is CG12, Cometary Globule Number 12. That's its official name. So Costa, my colleague, Costa Getman, had the brilliant insight to take very short snapshots, not only of the cloud, but even around the cloud. I don't know how he got this idea, but it was just so clever. And he found all these colored circles are X-ray sources. And these contours show the molecular cloud. It has a molecular core. It has a couple of protostars that people knew about inside the very center there. But we found that there are dozens and dozens of X-ray sources that are around. And this is why around I'm talking about, this is 2 parsecs. No, 4 parsecs in all directions in front of the cloud. So this one must have been huge and has been ablated downward and leaving behind, or else, thank you, Chris, they have moved outwards. We have, because they're so close, we actually have...
The cloud is being pushed out.
And yes, that's another possibility. We don't really believe that, but it's a possibility. Okay, we don't really know the faster physics of this. I think this is to be done by real theorists to explain this. We have ages for these. They're close enough that we actually have photometry just from the surveys. And the ages show amazing ranges, up to 20 million years down to protostars. So this cometary globule is 10 times bigger than the usual RDI simulation. It probably took much longer to photo-ionize it and ablate it.
Hey, have you taken out the background sources?
There are a few background sources, but very few. And the answer is we know because they're 15th and bright magnitude stars and brighter. And the background sources are 23rd magnitude or something. So it's very easy for us to get rid of the quasars, and we've gotten rid of them. Okay. You know, table one has them, but all the figures don't. Okay. So yes, we've gotten rid of them. These are real stars. Okay. And sure enough, we're getting some optical astronomer to work at minus 40 declination to take some spectra and confirm it. Until that has something called lithium observations, no one's for sure. But most of these are going to be fine. There may be a few mistakes that we make, but not many. So I'd like to end my talk with W3. And W3 is it's actually mostly known to VLA radio astronomers, Crystal. It was an early work at Westerbork in the VLA. Beautiful work, because it had the best collection of ultra-compact H2 regions you could get in one field of view. And it was really very beautiful. I'll show you that picture in just a minute. What I want to show you here, this is our X-ray mosaic. There's a whole theory about this. This is a wonder. W345 is one of my favorite regions. It's about 2 degrees big. W5 is here, and then there's a gap. And W4 is this huge chimney. Norman and Akuchi predicted chimneys. It's the best chimney that's around for them, with a huge enclosed super bubble down here. There's an IC1805 cluster, and there's an IC1795 cluster. That's over here. And then there's another molecular cloud over here that has all sorts of star formation, and it's well known. It has full of masers and ultra-compact H2 regions and all sorts of evidence of high-mass star formation at exactly 2.00 kiloparsecs. They actually know, they've done maser astrometry. They know the distance to within 1%. That's amazingly accurate. So this is called W3 Main. That's called W3 North. That's called W3OH. Those names are about 30 years old. They come from mainly radio and infrared astronomers. This is the X-ray picture. This is new. Now, Spitzer has looked at it. I've now put our little sources on the Spitzer picture, not the whole thing. This is W3 Main, and this is W3OH. And you can see that Spitzer's fantastic at showing the illuminated PAH dust, but is pretty bad at finding the stellar population. First, in the middle, it's just blazed out, saturated by the PAH emission, the diffuse emission. They just can't see any stars. And out here, they can see them, but they have lots and lots of background sources and foreground sources, and they can only look at the ones that are younger that have disks, and there's only a few that have real disks, so they only get a very small handful. We get a much bigger population. And we get the foreground population of the unobscured cluster and the embedded population separately. But look here, look at that blip, 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 blip. Okay, this very sort of blip, this lumpy thing, I'm going to show you that in just a minute, in X-rays. And here it is. These are very diverse. The W3 main is a rich and spherical, if you take the smooth map, it looks like a bunch of concentric spheres very closely. Region, here's the inner few parsecs of it. It's quite heavily obscured, so it's almost all in green in this picture. And it just looks like a nice round spherical cluster, like a cluster is supposed to look like. It looks like an Orion Nebula cluster. It's round. It's even rounder than an Orion Nebula cluster. W3OH to the south is sparser. It's about 15 times sparser, depending how you draw your contours. But it's lumpy. So about 10 stars here and another 10 or 15 here. We don't see something called the Turner-Welch object, and don't worry about it. This is all well studied. There's dozens and dozens of studies down here in radio and millimeter and infrared. And we see some of them and not others of them, but we mainly see all these new stars that they sort of didn't remark on. We see a bunch here and a bunch there, clump, 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 clump.
What are your mass, typical mass, what's your mass cutoff here?
It's going to be about half a solar mass, roughly. It's a little hard to know. Obscuration is pretty bad here and probably variable. And maybe each star has its own limit. It's not so simple.
If you have only 70 stars down to half a solar mass, then you wouldn't predict very many.
I don't think there are many there. It's not that discrepancy seems to be present in the BNKL region, where there's a whole bunch of B stars, and we did not find the rich lower mass population. That's another. If you want to find, you want to know what my favorite top heavy little cluster is, it's the BN cluster, and we have that in the Grosso paper. I have a copy here if you want to look at it. We were unable to prove it statistically, but emotionally, I'm convinced. Okay. There are just not enough stars to be statistical about it, but it seems true. Here, I don't think that discrepancy is there, but I must admit we haven't checked. W3 North is amazingly different. It's just like the O4 star in Rosette in the bottom. This one's in the north. It's totally isolated. There's not a single companion anywhere. This is the one that has lousy proper motion observations. Okay. So it's a very bright star. It's not very hard to study. Just no one's bothered to study it in decades of work. I mean, again, Miller-Goss has studies from the 1970s on this, and that's the last time anyone studied these things. So what we're doing is we're trying to revive studies, not of the gas around these star-forming regions, but of the stars in the cluster. And we now need whole hosts of optical and infrared astronomers to go study the stars that we have basically uncovered with Chandra. And Chandra is going to uncover about 30,000 of them by the year 2010. That's my estimate. We won't have published them all. And by we, they'll be half Penn State and half all of our rivals. And it's very hard to crunch through so much information so quickly. But we're going to give you theorists vast new data sets that are similar to what I'm showing you here, and that have themes that are similar to what I'm showing, except we'll do new themes if you can tell us what to do. So I predict this one's going to be our real runaway. And in particular, some theorists wrote down a sparse cluster idea that doesn't apply here quite clearly. Now, here's the very center of it. This is the famous, in 1997, I must be wrong, Crystal, this can't be VLA, it must be Westerbork. It's a very famous Westerbork picture or whatever. It has ultra-compact H2 regions. M right there is where the massive star formation is most active today. It has hyper-compact H2 regions, ultra-compact H2 regions, compact H2 regions, and diffuse H2 regions. And there's no way for these very small ones to be older than about 10 to the 4 years old. You can stall them a little bit, but basically we're looking at just formed OB stars.
Why is that?
Because they're so small. There's a standard theory for the expansion of ultra-compacts.
Yeah. Yeah, which is clearly wrong.
Well, thank you very much. You can go and write papers and explain why they're all wrong, okay? But using the standard theories, and I've read the latest of them, okay, one can, under unusual conditions, stall them, but it seems unlikely you can stall all of them.
Well, I guess.
Okay, yeah. So just wait. Next slide, and then we'll talk, okay. So what we've done is not, of course, tell you anything about the OB stars in here. They were already known because of the radio emission. what we've done, of course, is add all the low mass stars, and here they are, in this sort of quasi-spherical, slightly things, and then you're centered right on something called IRS5, which is the youngest, most massive protostar in the region. And there was a K-band image that found some of these, but they couldn't see the whole picture of things. In particular, they couldn't go out to 5 parsecs diameter and show that it's a big, relaxed, round structure, and that it's not sort of triggered, doesn't look triggered in any way. It looks round. Okay. So, the Chandra constraints on the formation of just that center region. Its large spherical morphology does not support triggering from the shock coming from this side. If it triggered from this side, it had to be ready, quasi-stable, and then it went boop, and it collapsed, and it made its stars. It implies instead slow extended cluster formation. Extended meaning big, slow meaning slow. Okay, and here are some papers from people in this room, okay, who have talked about the possibilities in the astrophysics of slow extended cluster formation. And there's a new paper by Staller, and there's an even newer one by Elmer Green, which I forgot to put on here in the last week. Okay, but what I really think, and we claimed in this paper, is that there is a discrepancy in the ages, that the OB stars, particularly of the smaller H2 regions, all hypercompact and ultracompact, have to be younger than the T Tauri stars. Because if the T Tauri stars were that age, they would all be class zeros and class ones. But the less than 1% of them have MIPS counterparts. They're barely even class twos. They're not protostars. There are very few protostars in this extended cluster. Therefore, this extended cluster is like all the other clusters we've seen, roughly 1 million years old. We don't know if it's 1 million or 500,000 or 2 million, but roughly 1 million. So if the cluster is 1 million years old, and the OB stars are 10 to the 5 years old, then the O stars had to have been born after the T Tauri stars, at the end of the cluster formation process. Now, Ji-Yun, okay, this is for people like you, and for people like you, Mark, and for people like you, Chris, okay? This is a case study for you, that we think, I think, is probably one of the most convincing case studies. It's not foolproof. One can wiggle out of it by messing up H2 region physics, wiggle out of it in other ways. But it's actually probably the strongest case that I know of the particular situation of a big round cluster forming over 1 million years, and at the end of it, forming the O stars in the middle. It's a very particular version of accelerated star formation, a very particular version of cluster formation and high mass star formation. There are not many options for this one. So this is one of the ones that I'm actually telling you something that I hope is useful. Nonetheless, we were unable, and as an observer reading you guys, to tell the difference. Is it star formation acceleration? Is it stellar mergers? Is it outflow turbulence? Is it dynamics of subclumps? Is it internal triggering? That last one may be a little unfamiliar. It's buried inside of the observers from the 1990s. It's a very interesting model. It says that the triggering is from the shocks of the small H2 regions of the next nearby O star. It triggered its own neighbor next to it. A very interesting idea that's not talked about, so I added it in there. The rest of it, almost everyone is in the room. No, not quite, but these are ideas that are talked about in your community as theorists, and this is a case study for you. So my talk is, in fact, over, and it is truly approaching 5 o'clock. It's not easy to give this talk because I've never given it. That was hard. This is Lisa and me, it's not just me. Lisa Townsley is really the leader of this. And she is as scientifically sophisticated as I am, and so it's very much of a joint work. And Junfen Wang did a lot of it, and Costa Getman's doing a lot. And we're really a group trying hard to take a different telescope and tell you something about our star clusters that you don't know from other wavelengths to help you and constrain your theories and to really move you forward. So, altogether, I don't know about you, but it's unexpected to me. If you read proposals of, you know, why motivate X-ray observatories in the 1960s, 70s, 80s, or even 90s, no one mentioned this. There was one paper in this field by Mr. Thierry Montmerle in the 1990s. I thought he was crazy. I was a co-author. Okay, Thierry always did that to me. He always had crazy ideas, and 10 years later, I slogged through it. He's always right, okay? So this is unexpected. This is not something that people had been talking about, that Chandra was going to do. So we don't know what's going to come out of this. It complements infrared, doesn't replace it. It's a different view. We're very good in this intermediate regime for IMFs. The IMFs generally agree with the Orion Nebula Cluster, which is a standard saltpeter function in this regime, although small deviations, and we're actually sensitive to small deviations, may be present. Not all the time, but often, the stellar population is dominated by a single rich spherical cluster several parsecs across. We saw that in M17, we saw that in W3, we saw that in Rosetta, we saw that in Orion, and we saw that in NGC 6357. Maybe I chose examples because we targeted them, okay, so, but at least I want you to know that it often occurs. So I think you should really try to create rich spherical clusters. Mass segregation is often present, but not always. Now, does that mean Rosette never mass segregated at the beginning? Or that it's a post-collapse dispersed, you know, after dynamical, collapse catastrophe has occurred? I don't know. What about those central cusps? It looks catastrophic to me. Are they born or are they made? And now we're really going to talk about runaways. Now, I want to let you know something, that if we talk about runaways in our pictures, those runaways are less than 10,000 years old. They are yesterday's runaways. They're not runaways. Most people talk about what are called field O stars. Their runaways are a million years ago, even 10 million years ago. You don't even know where they came from most of the time. So these are runaways that just ran away. So that's very different astronomy. It's not the normal.
Then you could tell that from proper motion studies.
Right. In fact, that's right. All we need is proper motion and even radial velocities. This should be within, if you just get good optical astronomers, we should be able to solve this particular question almost instantly. However, even though there's often a rich spherical cluster, there's often secondary asymmetrical triggered populations. Not all the time, but often. One could say the Beckler-Neugebauer region may be triggered. I'm not sure, but it could be. Certainly M17, very convincing. Certainly the bright-rimmed clouds, where we have the RDI model very nicely confirmed, certainly. Certainly that weird cometary globule, even though I can't figure out what's triggering it, it sure looks triggered. So I would say that we're beginning to tell you something about triggering, although I'm not sure exactly what we're telling you. In some cases, it looks clear. And finally, I think you shouldn't look for a single thing. I think that maybe when you guys have different models of cluster formation or of high mass star formation, maybe you're all right. You should make friends instead of enemies or something. Because we see diversity. We don't seem to see a single structure. In W3, we find three totally different morphologies. We have a rich spherical cluster. We have a lumpy triggered cluster with 10% the richness of that, or a few percent. And then we have an isolated O star. We don't even know if it was born there or thrown there. And all these three were known to infrared astronomers, but they didn't say what I'm saying. They couldn't see the whole sort of picture of where the stars are in the picture. So this particular component called W3 main, the rich cluster in the middle of W3, is a strong case for a particular situation of long duration formation of low mass star formation over many several parsecs, followed by later rapid formation of central OB stars in the middle over tens of parsecs. And as I said, this work has just begun. Thank you.
This last conclusion only comes from your H2 region age.
Yeah. You see, in the Orion, there have been an argument that has never been resolved by either observers or theorists. Are the O stars in Orion as old as the younger stars, which means a million years old? And those, that's well known. There's a range of age from 1 million, half a million to 10 million. Most of them are 1 to 2 million. Or are they younger? And one argument has been the propelid evaporation should occur in 10 to the 5 years. So if there's still propelids around, that means the O star is only turned on. I don't believe that argument very much because there could be elliptical orbits. And they're just coming in today. Well, and they'd be evaporating today. And there were a bunch that evaporated yesterday. So you don't really know. Okay, so it's not convincing. Nobody can tell you the age of an O star if you just look at it. But if it's surrounded by an H2 region, there is a theory that tells you the age. You may say the theory's lousy, and it is, sure. Let's not use the word lousy, why don't we say it's complex, but it's very well established.
I'm actually going to agree with you,
there's actually dozens and dozens and dozens of studies on the morphologies and physics of ultra-compact H2.
So the issue where the theory runs into trouble is the H2 region lifetime problem, which
yes.
is
Churchill and Woods skeptics.
So that if, you know, you should never see ultra-compact H2 regions if they were just expanding as the Spitzer solution says they should, because they would be too short-lived. But that's a problem for very young ages. If you're talking about saying these things are not more than 10 to 5 years old, there isn't a lifetime problem, and the Spitz and the, you know, the Spitzer solution is probably okay.
Right.
So you know, if you, I would agree with you if you took your ages of 10 to the 4, you know, to 10 to the 5 years and just replaced it by less than 10 to the 5.
Yes, that's right. Yes, and then it would be identical to us. And I actually agree with you on that one too.
Okay.
Yes, I really do.
Yeah, so I think that resolves the issue. It's less than 10 to 5.
You really have to push.
Kevin, how long is 10 to 5?
No.
It's a little bit longer. I mean, this problem first came up when Boyd and Churchwell did their survey. Yeah. And they get about 10% of the H2 regions were these ultra compact.
Right.
So it's about 10% of the age. And the youngest age of an O-star is 2 million years, but the typical age is actually probably a little bit longer. And then if you need 10%, so it's hundreds. It's
fine. You want 2 10 to the 5 instead of 1 10 to the 5.
Well, no, it could be 5 10 to the 5.
If you push it, I guess. Yeah. And yeah, a few tens to the five.
Yeah, a few tens to the five.
Do you mean for the particular picture you showed, wasn't
well, that's interesting. In fact, can I just tell you what Tief Trunk said? Okay. No one reads him because he was a radio astronomer observer who wrote these brilliant papers in ANA 10 years ago. But deep inside his papers, he suggested that because there was such a diversity of sizes, that there was actually a range of ages in the O stars alone. So it's possible, Lisa thinks, that one possible interpretation is that some O stars formed along with the broad Tutori stars, and they formed A, B, and G or something, the bigger ones. And they're not so concentrated, maybe they drifted out or something like this. And then something later, Jiyun, something later, something delayed another round of O star formation. And then there was a burst of O-star formation, but that would have had to be very top-heavy.
See, I don't think the diversity of H2 region sizes, I mean, the interpretation that seems more natural to me is that, so the picture I have is that the H2 regions will stay confined as long as, say, you continue dumping matter on them as long as it's still embedded. And then once you take away the confining element, they expand very quickly. So I wouldn't necessarily interpret the diversity of age or of sizes as a diversity of ages. I might interpret it as, you know, you have some that are still accreting, and the ones that are the largest are the ones, you know, they only stopped accreting, you know, 10 to 5 years ago. But as soon as they stop accreting, they expand very rapidly.
I would also really like to know, what's the molecular density around A, H, and D, and what's the molecular around M, F, and E, and see whether it's 10 times denser there than here. That would do it too. It may not be age at all.
I think you could very easily get that diversity of sizes with almost no age.
So what I want to say is that there's this fascinating situation here. W3 has been sort of forgotten since these beautiful papers by Tief Trunk, who's left the field, and it's really beautiful issues to talk about in W3.
Yeah, another question about, so having to do with the ages. So I'm wondering if, since you're finding all of these old, no longer accreting stars that have been missed by previous surveys, I'm wondering if you sort of put your data together with the existing data, does accelerating star formation go away? I mean, is it just that, the accelerating star formation picture is just that, well, they're missing most of the 3-million-year-old stars because they're excluded by the survey selection criteria?
I made myself something of a pain. Personal pain, because I said that about 10 times to Steve Stoller and Francesco Palla, who are my friends, okay? So it was very difficult. I said, how do you know your samples are complete, particularly for the older ones? And I even gave them an example, something called Chameleon 1, where it was consistent that the older stars had drifted out of the field that they were considering just by drifting. Forget about ejection, just by drifting. And I wrote it in a paper. No, they didn't believe me. And so I always accused them of not having good samples because they relied too much on the optical infrared astronomers. Actually, I think there may be accelerated star formation. I'm not so sure they're wrong. The evidence in favor of their model, or that kind of inconstancy, is actually growing, I think. There are these age spreads with rapid formation at the tails being found over and over again, and I'm not sure they're wrong.
Well, for the O stars, you're arguing, but I mean, I'm wondering.
No,
even?
Yeah, it's a good question. Let me phrase it my way, Mark, and see whether my phrasing of the issue helps you. I'm not going to phrase it in a more observational way. The way I would say it is, let's just take Taurus or something like this. If you take the classical T-Tauris in Taurus, one would have said that star formation in Taurus began about 1 million years ago. And you have protostars of class zeros, class ones, and class twos, more or less a reasonable distribution of them for 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5, and 10 to the 6 years. There's no Wood Churchill effect in that problem. Okay, that's how they got the ages almost, phenomenologically. What the X-ray astronomer has done over 20 years has add a whole lot of WTTs to that sample. And of course, most of them are older than 2 million years. Most of them are 3 million years, 5 million years, even 10 million years. But some of the WTTs overlap in age with the CTTs, if you put them on an H-R diagram. So they're diskless stars, accretionless, non-accreting stars, whose age on an H-R diagram is a couple tenths of a million years, 10 to the 5. Mm-hmm. Are these common? No. Are they here? They exist. They overlap the age distributions of WTTs to CTTs. And some CTTs have been found that are surprisingly old. When you finally put the star on the diagram, they're 10 million years old. There are not many of those either. So I think what this means from my point of view, and I don't know if this is exactly what you're asking, from my point of view, what this means is that the longevity of accretion, the longevity of inner disks and of outer disks, is not a number. It's a broad distribution, and that disk longevities have a big distribution. And the kind of number I'd like to see is if we could only get more, like one number, like the median. What's the median duration of accretion phase, of inner disk, let's say K-band excess or L-band excess, and of outer disks, let's say Spitzer excess. And my personal opinion is that the median age for inner disks and accretion may very well be as early as half a million years. In other words, by half a million to a million years, half of the stars have stopped accreting in their WTTs. And I've had a dream that someday I would try to write a paper and pin that down. And I haven't buckled down. It's a matter of understanding our selection effects and their selection effects very, very well. And it's not easy to buckle down. But just, I want you to know that as an experienced observer, I can almost assure you that this longevity is broad. It's broader than the Hayes-Schlatter-Lotta diagram, which I don't think is reliable, because they don't include X-ray selected samples in a wise way. I think there are both longer-lived systems and shorter-lived loss of systems. So there is no average moment when planets form. Different stars have different duration disks. That's also seen in the wide diversity of rotational structures, rotational velocities in the planets.
What's the answer to Mark's question? That is, in your opinion, are the data supportive of accelerating star formation, or would you say that at the present time, the data are not good enough to establish it?
I certainly believe that the data before the year 2001, when they published it, did not substantiate their work, and I thought they were a little weak on that. Since then, the Orion data continues to support them.
Even X-ray data.
And yes, we didn't influence the Orion Nebula data, but other people improved it and all came up with the same result, that there's a 10 million year old tail, and there's a couple other explanations.
So you didn't find enough, sort of 3 or 5 million year old stars to significantly increase it relative to the population they had?
In Orion, we found 10 new unobscured stars. Not enough to change any story,
Okay. Because
it was extremely well studied. And we'd never expected to change the Orion story, and we never did. We found about 70 embedded.
So you think it's still accelerating in Orion, and
I think those people are probably okay.
But in Taurus, you found more?
Taurus is a lousy place to ask the question. And now this is where I've had, I already told you how, I've disagreed with wonderful people like Steve and Francesco. I've also disagreed with wonderful people like Lee Hartman, who has done statistical studies of the populations in Taurus. But the reason I don't like Taurus is that it is 500 square degrees big. I'm not joking. It's about that big in the sky. And you can't survey the whole thing. And it has all these 6 active clouds today, and a million years ago it probably had 10 other active clouds. You don't even know which ones they were. So when you go on large scales, everything's overlapping. It's like a palimpsest, to use an old-fashioned word. And you can't figure anything out. You don't know where things came from. If you really want a beautiful study of a population of a low-mass region, please read the papers, including a 2007 paper and now a 2008 paper you haven't seen yet, by Kevin Luhmann. L-U-H-M-A-N, who's in my department now as a young faculty member. And he does fantastic work on a beautiful isolated one where there's no layering. And he has, if not accelerated star formation, he certainly has a long history of star formation. In that case, I said it was like a simmering pot that just simmers forever.
Makes a long history versus accelerated.
In the case of Chameleon 1, I don't think there's much acceleration. But there is very much long history. In the case of Orion, it looks more like acceleration, but Orion's tough. And I will say that this case looks, well, you interpret it as you choose, but it looks like the O stars formed in a burst recently, and I don't know. The reason I don't know about it is that we need 8-meter adaptive optics, 10-micron studies of the disks around here. Did you understand that's really hard? Okay, but there's an instrument called Vizier that can do it, and there's another one on Gemini North, I think, that can do it. It's just on the edge of doability today. So I'd love someone in that area to try to find a disk fraction. If they're all class 1s and class 0s, then there was a burst of a complete IMF. If they're all class 3s, then there was a burst just of O stars, or something anomalous about H2 regions.
Okay, I think perhaps we should thank Eric.
Thank you very much. So I'm down the hall, and I hope to I chat with you guys about anything about X-rays.
Well, people can chat with them over beer. Are you coming here?